Amen. Well, you guys can be seated. And thank you again for joining us on this holiday weekend, especially as we kick off a new series called A People After God. Basically, what we're going to be doing over the series next several weeks is looking at different stories in the Bible, some of these stories of people you may be somewhat familiar with, some of them maybe you've never really heard before, and seeing what did they do, what did God do in their life, and what can we learn from them. And to kick this off, I don't know if you heard the story of the middle-aged woman who she had a heart attack, and she was taken to the hospital. And while she was on the operating table, she had a near-death experience. And during this near-death experience, she sees God and she asks him, "Is this it?" And God says, "No." And then he actually explains to her that he's actually going to give her another 30 years to live. And so upon her recovery, she's like, "This is amazing. I've got 30 more years. And since I'm already in the hospital, I'm going to go ahead and stay. I'll go ahead and get a facelift, maybe some liposuction, a tummy tuck, and all these different cosmetic procedures." She even had someone come in and dye her hair. And so she's like ready to rock and roll for the next 30 years. She figures since she's got, again, 30 more years, she might as well make the most of it. And so as she's feeling really good about herself, she walks out of the hospital after the last operation and is killed by getting hit by an ambulance which was speeding by. Now, she gets pretty upset about this. She's angry when she arrives in front of God, and she's disappointed. And she complains, "I thought you said I had another 30 years." To which God responded by saying, "I am so sorry. I didn't recognize you." And, you know, I share that story because she was upset, right? She was disappointed. I was promised this one thing, and it didn't go the way I thought it was going to go. And while that's obviously a fictional story, I share that because today I want to look at something that might be a little bit more heavy to all of us. And really the question we're going to be looking at this morning is this: what should we do when we are disappointed with God? So what do we do in our life when we feel like God maybe owes us something, or God has led us something, or maybe we thought God kind of promised, or we just assumed, hey, if we do this, God will do this, or maybe you haven't assumed anything, but you've been trying to faithfully follow Jesus, and for whatever reason, there's been something that has happened or things that are happening in your life that have caused you to be disappointed with God. And the question is, what do you do if you are in that situation? That's what we're going to be looking at this morning. And so we're going to be this morning in 1 Samuel chapter 1. I'm going to give you a little bit of background so you can understand what's going on in this text. If you have a Bible, we'll be on page 223 in the black ones. And as always, if you don't have a Bible, there's black ones in the back of the auditorium. You can grab one of those. And you can bring one of those home and take one home if you don't own a Bible. Happy for you to do that. It's our gift to you. Now, really quick, the background behind 1 Samuel is this. It begins with the birth of the prophet Samuel, who is going to become the leading prophet during Israel's transition from its period of the judges, which is what initially happened when they were in Israel. They didn't have any kings. They had different judges that would sprout out from time to time after they entered the promised land. And so Samuel is going to kind of be the transition from the period of the judges to the period of having kings. If you have read the book of Judges, you know by the end of Judges, things are not going well. Typically in the book of Judges, Israel falls into sin. They cry out to God, and God graciously rescues them. By the end of the book of Judges, they're not even crying out to God anymore. And he's still been gracious to rescue them, but they're not even crying out to God anymore. Things are not going well. And 1 Samuel, the book, really highlights two major events. Again, the transition to the monarchy in Israel. And second, the preparation for King David to sit on the royal throne after King Saul. But before you can read any of those things, you have to read about Samuel himself. So the context here, 1 Samuel chapter 1, likely takes place around 1080 to 1070 BC. So about-ish 1100-ish years before Jesus is born in Israel, this is when this story takes place. And so I'm going to read, starting in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. Here's what it says. It says, "There was a man from Ramathim-Zophim in the hill country of Ephraim. His name was Elkanah, son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, an Ephraimite." An Ephraimite means it's the clan of Israel that he was from. "He had two wives. The first was named Hannah, and the second was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah was childless. This man would go from town to town every year to worship and to sacrifice the Lord of armies at Shiloh," which was a city in the area of Israel, "where Eli's two sons," Eli was the high priest, "Hophni and Phinehas were the Lord's priests." So I want to say this. First of all, community groups start next week, not this week. You're welcome, so that you don't have to read that. Second thing I want to say this is that Elkanah, here's all I say. Here's Elkanah. He's going to be on the scene. Elkanah has two wives. Now, I want to say this. While the Old Testament has many instances where it describes a polygamous situation like this one, it never actually endorses it. In fact, what the Bible endorses is the Genesis ideal of one man and one woman. And so what you happen is that every single time that you see a polygamous relationship in the Old Testament, every single time, it always creates tension, heartbreak, and conflict. It's like the biblical authors are trying to say, hey, man, this isn't a good thing. And so that's what we're going to see here. Between Hannah and Peninnah, there's going to be a conflict and heartbreak between these two women. Now, I also just want to say this, certainly not defending the act of Elkanah having two wives, but I do want to say in the ancient world, which is much different than where we live today, there were several reasons why a man might have multiple wives, and not all of them were actually bad. So, for example, one reason a man might take another wife is called a levirate marriage, where in the ancient world, it wasn't like today, where you're like, oh, I love you, you love me, we love each other, we're going to, like, get married. Most marriages were arranged, and if you married someone who had been divorced or widowed, you most often would not, like, arrange for your child to marry someone in that situation. Also, in the ancient world, women generally couldn't work, they couldn't own land, they couldn't do a lot of things, and so they really relied on some sort of relationship to a husband or a father or an uncle or a brother. And so if you are a widowed woman, for whatever reason, your life situations were very, very bleak. And so a levirate marriage was essentially, hey, if your husband dies, then a brother or someone like that in the family would take you on as a wife, would care for you and would try to provide for you and if you have any children. So I just want to say, we don't know the situation behind why Elkanah has two wives, but it could be a situation where one of these women was previously married, was divorced or widowed for whatever reason, and he has stepped up to provide for her. So we don't know why, but he has two wives. This man is, again, likely from the tribe of Levi, which he's clearly very religious. And at this point in Israel's history, Shiloh was where the tabernacle was located. So again, when the Israelites were traveling through the Promised Land, they had the tabernacle where the Lord's presence dwelled, where they would do sacrifices, all these things. At this point, again, there's a temple has not yet been built, and Shiloh, the city of Shiloh, is where the tabernacle dwelled. And so this is where many Israelites would make various pilgrimages to worship the Lord. It was the most holy place to worship, and that's where they go. Lastly, I just want to point this out. Hannah, again, she is childless, which would not only be a point of great sadness for her, but also great social difficulty for her in the ancient world. Pretty much your retirement, your care for old age is on your children, your safety net, and kind of an area of social shame if you were a woman in the ancient world who did not have children. So this is hard for her, especially because Peninnah, the other wife, has kids. So here's what we say. We pick up the story, verse 4, it says this. Whenever Elkanah offered a sacrifice, he always gave portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to each of her sons and daughters. So these sacrifices here, this is what is called a peace offering. And in a peace offering, some parts of the animal were burned up. Some parts were given to the priests as kind of like a payment to help care for them. And some parts are eaten by the people offering the sacrifice. So he would do this, verse 5. But he gave a double portion to Hannah, for he loved her, even though the Lord had kept her from conceiving. In other words, whatever cultural shame that Hannah might have felt for not having kids, we do know it was not because her husband still clearly loved her. Verse 6, her rival, so talking about Peninnah, her rival would taunt her severely just to provoke her, because the Lord had kept Hannah from conceiving. So again, the text does not speak favorably on this marriage situation, and an astute Bible reader would be reminded of the stories, for example, of Sarah and Hagar from the story of Abraham, and how they too were bitter towards each other. You would also hear echoes of the story of Rachel and Leah, again, the wives of Isaac. One was pregnant at first, one could not have kids, and how there was a rivalry there. Things were not going well. Verse 7, year after year, so this isn't just like a one-time thing. This is going on for a period of time. She went up to the Lord's house. So they would travel to Shiloh every year, and her rival taunted her in this way. In other words, it wasn't the fact that she also just didn't have kids, but Peninnah intentionally used Hannah's infertility to wound her, especially, it seems, during their yearly travel to Shiloh, which was supposed to be a time of worship and community and like memories and fellowship, good times. It was supposed to be a good time. Peninnah would go out of her way to make sure that Hannah would feel a certain way about the situation. Goes on, verse 7, Hannah would weep and not eat. So at the time of big celebration and festival and everyone's supposed to be in a good mood, Hannah would not eat. Verse 8, Hannah, why are you crying? Her husband Elkanah would ask. Why won't you eat? Why are you troubled? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? So again, just a reminder, this is a time before refrigerators. You know, you can't go to like the restaurant. So going to like offer a sacrifice, this is like some of the best meal you would have the entire year. And she wouldn't eat. He says, am I not better than you than 10 sons? Now this expression that he shares with her is used by Hannah's husband as an ancient idiom, which basically was this idea that children, especially sons in the ancient world, were valued for their economic support and the safety net they provided. So having 10 sons is like a hyperbolic way of saying, hey, you're blessed and you're going to be cared for. A blessing and honor. And so he's like, man, am I not better to you than this? And so while, of course, his words don't fix the situation, it just does seem like Hannah's husband is a good dude. Like he's a genuinely good dude, and he still deeply cares for her, even if she does not have children. So she's obviously really upset about the situation, as probably anyone in her situation would be. But her husband is like trying to care for her well. Verse 9, it says this, on one occasion, Hannah got up after they ate and drank at Shiloh. The priest Eli, so he is the high priest at the time, was sitting on a chair by the doorpost of the Lord's temple. So at the tabernacle, he's kind of sitting near the entrance. Verse 10, deeply hurt, Hannah prayed to the Lord and wept many tears. So she's like right up at the temple, like as close as you can really be without going in or being a priest or anything like that. And she's like weeping. She's childless. She has been intentionally provoked year after year by Peninnah. She's undoubtedly, obviously, spiritually struggling. Like, why won't God answer this really good desire that I have? It's like, I'm not asking for a bigger house or to take that trip to Europe. Like, I'm just asking for, like, to survive. I'm just asking for kids that are a good blessing from the Lord. I'm not asking for anything bad. And I would guess, while your situation in some cases may be different, but also for some of you, in some ways, may be similar, man, all of us know what it is like to be distraught, to be unsure, to be confused. And whether it has caused you to weep or not, I think most of us know what it is like to have a deep longing for something that is a very good thing and have God not give it to us. You have a deep longing for something that's very good, and God has not answered us. And it's not just that he has not given it to us, but then also you begin to feel distant from God in the midst of it. Because Hannah here, she's not just like sad or kind of upset. Man, she's devastated. She's devastated. Again, here is Hannah. She's in their tabernacle area where families have traveled to worship. That there's people everywhere. There's kids everywhere. They're running around. Peninnah and her children are laughing and playing and eating really good food. And every year, Hannah has to be reminded how she doesn't have that. That she doesn't have that. The one thing that she wants most, these children, she does not have. And going to the tabernacle every year only makes it worse. You know exactly what that's like. This is like the holidays. It's like Thanksgiving and Christmas. When you're going through a hard time, and the holidays actually make it worse. And it doesn't help that, you know, you see the Instagram and you see online everyone's posting pictures of their kids and their good meals and their families being together, and yet you have a broken relationship with a child, or you haven't had kids, or maybe you had a death in the family, or you've had a really hard year, finances are really tight, a really bad diagnosis. And so everybody, pictures, you know, the Christmas music, you know, we're singing Christmas carols, everyone's wishing you a Merry Christmas, and you are, like, it is only making things worse. It makes, like, the sadness, the depression, the anger, the doubt, the confusion, it only amplifies it. And this is where Hannah is. And again, I just want to say, listen, this is how some of you feel like right now. Like if you're just being honest, like if we could be honest, like maybe some of you are struggling maybe with infertility. And you know this, man, if you're part of New City, all these people keep having babies like every week. And every time someone has a baby, it's like two more women are pregnant. And like no joke, at any given time this year, we've had, it seems like about a quarter of our family is currently out on maternity leave. Like, that's just what's happening. There's babies everywhere. And so that's you, and you already want a child. You're begging desperately that God would bless you, But yet you keep coming to worship God just like Hannah, but then coming to a place like this actually makes it worse because you see all these kids running around that you don't have. Or maybe there's a job situation or financial situation, a health situation, maybe a longing, a desire, a prayer that you've prayed for a long time that has not happened. And then you come to church to worship God, which you know you should do and you know is a good thing. And in some ways, coming here actually makes it worse that you can relate to Hannah. But in the midst of it, Hannah keeps showing up. She keeps showing up to the very place year after year that is the hardest for her to go to. And so I just want to say one of the lessons that we can learn from Hannah, although difficult, is this, that you can pursue God in the midst of your pain. You can continue to pursue God in the midst of your doubts, in the midst of your depression, in the midst of your confusion, in the midst of your pain. That her response to disappointment was not to withdraw from God, but to press into him with her disappointment. So she's not pretending like everything's fine, but she's also not running away. She's like, Lord, this is really awful. I'm really disappointed. I'm really confused, but I'm going to continue to show up. And again, she's persistent because she's done this multiple years, like multiple years, and she still has not given up. In fact, in verse 10, we're told that Hannah is deeply hurt and she's weeping with many tears. And yet here she is at the tabernacle, the place that only makes it difficult and more hard for her. She's seeking the presence of God. That she doesn't hide her pain, or she doesn't pretend that everything is fine, that she brings her sorrow, her disappointment, and even her doubt directly to the Lord. That Hannah is showing us here that faith, again, is not the absence of struggling. It is bringing our struggle to God. And here's what happens, man. Like many of us believe that we need to get it together before we can approach God. We've got to get our act together. We've got to clean up. We've got to pray. We've got to do these things. But Hannah, man, like Hannah shows us the exact opposite, that you don't have to wait until you feel strong to pray, or that you don't have doubts to pray, that you don't need to have like the perfect words or like a tidy heart, that you can be grieving, that you can be doubting, that you can be hurting, and you can still seek God. And in fact, this is often when we need him the most. And so, man, I would just encourage you, like, if you read the book of Psalms, or if you read the book of Lamentations, or if you even read the book of Job, what do you see is sometimes the most powerful thing you and I can do is to worship the Lord in the midst of your pain. In fact, in Hebrews chapter 4, we're actually encouraged to do this. So, as you know, if you will read the green word out loud with me when we get there, here's what the author of Hebrews writes in the New Testament. It says this, "For we do not have a high priest," talking about Jesus, "who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses." He continues on, "Therefore, because our high priest Jesus can sympathize with us and he draws near to the brokenhearted, therefore," here's what we should do. "We should let us approach the throne of grace with boldness." So not timidity, not God, like if you want to, like not God, if I do better than you might, but it says like in our weaknesses, we can approach the throne of grace with boldness. Why? So that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in time of need. So, man, this is what she's doing. She's not like being timid. She's not pretending that she's got everything together, that there's no issues. Like, she didn't care who knows or who sees. She's seeking the Lord, man, with boldness and asking. And she's keeping showing up. And then she says this, verse 11, it says this, "Making a vow, she pleaded, 'Lord of armies, if you will take notice of your servant's affliction, remember and not forget me, and give your servant a son. I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and his hair will never be cut." Now, I want to point this out. She refers to the Lord, God, as Lord of armies. Now, he's referred to this way verse 2, but this is the first time that an actual person in speech in the entire Old Testament or in the entire Bible refers to God as the Lord of armies. Now, God is, again, referred to 280 times this way in the Bible. The first time by a person is Hannah here. Now, Lord of armies is a way of emphasizing God's supreme power, that he is able to do the impossible, that no one or nothing can stop him, that he can produce victory in any situation. That's what she's calling him. And she here, she's making a vow to God. Now, that God, if you will give me a son, I will dedicate him to you. Now, she is most likely referring to what is called a Nazirite vow, which you can read more about in Numbers chapter 6, where for a certain period of time, you would not cut your hair, you would follow certain dietary food restrictions as a way of consecrating yourself to God. And so what Hannah is doing is she's offering her son to be a lifelong servant to the Lord, if the Lord will respond in this way. So she's praying, she's begging God. She's confidently, boldly praying before the Lord, verse 12. While she continued praying in the Lord's presence, Eli, again, he's the high priest, and he's like, sees this, watched her mouth. Hannah was praying silently, though her lips were moving. Her voice could not be heard. Eli thought she was drunk. And he said to her, "How long are you going to be drunk? Get rid of your wine." In other words, Eli sees her, and he thinks she is drunk based on her appearance. She's very disheveled. Obviously, she's been crying. And her response, that she's like praying and her lips are moving, but she's not saying anything. So she's acting like she's drunk, which, by the way, not only is like not a wise, great thing to do, but it's an offensive thing to do to come to the tabernacle, the presence of the Lord, like that. So he's probably like, not just like, "Why? What are you doing?" but like angrily rebuking her for what he assumes being drunk at this temple or at the tabernacle. And he rebukes her. Verse 15, she responds by saying, "No, my Lord," Hannah replied, "I am a woman with a broken heart. I haven't had any wine or beer. I've been pouring my heart out before the Lord. Don't think of me as a wicked woman. I've been praying from the depth of my anguish and resentment." So I just like want to say, she says she's praying from her anguish and her resentment. So in the story, in the Bible, we have a story of a woman who is deeply grieving, who's deeply bitter and resentful towards God. But she's bringing it to him. She's not hiding it. She's bringing it to him. In the midst of her doubts and her confusion, she is seeking God. And so I would just say, at least for her, and the reason I think this is in the text is for us to know that there is no tension here. That we can go before the Lord feeling a certain way and still boldly asking for him to move. Because she knows, regardless, like at the end of the day, he is the only one who can change your situation. He's the only one that can change your situation. So much so that, check this out, she does not let her pride or her public appearance get in the way of, by the way, appropriately responding to God. If you were her, this is the most appropriate way to respond to God. Not like, "I'm going to pretend like I'm okay," or just like in a quiet place in my heart, in my house where nobody can see, then I'm going to ask. Like, she is going all out. It's that big of a deal. And I think if we're just being honest, if you're to be honest with yourself, I'll be honest with myself, man, there are many times in our lives when we genuinely want something from God, but we want it on our terms. So we want this good thing from God, but what we really do is we want him to do it, but do it on our terms. So we might want a better marriage, or we might want a child, or we might want a job or a breakthrough or an addiction to be broken, as long as nobody else knows. As long as we can show up on Sunday and look good and look impressive and say everything's okay, right? So we can act like, "Hey, everything's fine. Like, I'm falling apart on the inside. I don't even know if I can continue following the Lord." But as long as nobody knows that, then I want him to move. But if I have to actually like share that with other people, then I feel like that's a little too much. And so what can happen, like if we're being honest, what can happen is, like, especially at New City, we got people down front after the sermon every week during the service to pray for you. What can happen is you have something really big going on in your life, but you never actually come forward because other people would then see that maybe you actually have a need in your life that you need God to answer. Or, you know, we're starting groups back up next week. Maybe you wouldn't tell your community group about it, that you got some going on, because then they would know that maybe your life isn't perfect. So again, what happens is you want God to move, but only if he does it on your terms. Or what we can also think too is we think like maybe like I've already prayed about this before. I've already prayed this like a dozen times. And so maybe I should stop praying about it as if there's like some sort of quota that you surpass and then God says like, I don't want to hear from you anymore. Again, this story for years, not just like a few months or like once a month, like for years, she is begging the Lord to move. And so I just like maybe like want to graciously say this. Listen, I don't think you can be mad at God for not responding to a deep longing of your heart if nobody else knows about it. Instead, what we should do is we should be like Hannah and seek the Lord regardless of what it looks like. That's what we should do. Because here's the reality. Listen, here's the reality. Pride will keep you from the presence of God. Pride will keep you from experiencing His grace and His mercy in your life. And pride, I think, at times can keep you from experiencing prayers that He wants to give you answer to in your life. So I would just be real with you. I'll give you an example. There's a couple in our community group that started coming to New City. I don't know. I'm bad on timelines. Maybe, let's just say a little over a year ago now. Something like that. And pretty early on to New City and to our group, they opened up about us about their infertility issues. And they kind of shared what was going on. And so we've been praying for them, you know, collectively, the guys, the girls, you know, at home, privately, that sort of thing. So we've been praying for them a while. And about 3 months ago, for the first time, they became pregnant. And that's awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. Now, here's the deal. Yeah, you if you're going to clap, you got to commit. Like, let's do this, all right? Now, I am not saying God heard the prayers of His people and therefore He answered them. But I am not saying He didn't. I'm not saying He didn't. Literally, I'm not making this up. Literally this week, I got a text from somebody. Because, you know, we do this prayer thing up front. We had someone that had come up for prayer for a couple times for this very same issue. And he was telling me how God not only answered the prayer this week, but it was, honestly, it was like more than they could have asked and imagined how he moved in this way. And he literally said, going up for prayer worked. It's like, it always works. Now, it might take time, it might be persistent. They didn't come up for prayer one time. This was a multiple process, a multiple month-long thing. And God moved like in a way that better than they weren't even asking for God to move this way, the way that He moved this week. And He answered it. The number of people I have had the privilege of praying over down front who have received an answer to prayer, the number of people that this has been true. And I'm not saying it's because they shared their need with others, so God did it. But I am also not saying it's not because of that. So I just want to say, like, I want to point this out too, man. Sometimes you're thinking, can I just encourage you? An answer to prayer in your life is not just for you. Like, you have no idea how your answered prayer can be an encouragement for other people in your community when they see God move on your behalf. And so what if God wants you to share what you need with someone else so that that person can also see God move and be encouraged to ask God to move in their life as well? It could very well be that God does want to grant what you're asking, but He wants you to tell someone else about it so that they can be encouraged in their walk with Jesus as well. I just want to say, we cannot make God answer our prayers and our desires. He is not a genie. He cannot be manipulated. And many times, listen, He does not answer them the way that we wish that He would. Many times that does happen. But at New City Church, man, here's the thing. Would it not be because we do not ask? That is not, that's the thing at us in New City. It's not going to be because we didn't ask. We say this often at New City. I just want to read you the verse, James 4:2. There's a lot of things going on in James chapter 4, but he says this. You desire and you do not have. You murder and covenant and cannot obtain. You fight and wage war. All that to say, though, you desire and you do not have. Here's why. You do not have because you do not ask. You don't ask. And so I just want to say, don't let your pride keep you from experiencing the blessings from God. So you should tell your community group. You should come and receive prayer when you need it. And then when God actually does respond in power and mercy in your life, or you can think of the ways that He has been gracious to you in the past, it is okay to like get after it in song. To actually like praise the Lord who has saved you from life to death, from death to life, has brought you from death to life, and is moving in power in your life today. Listen, Hannah is seeking the Lord, and she does not care who knows it. She does not care. There is no pride. There is no like, hey, I'm gonna ask the Lord to move. And so in response, here's what Eli says, verse 17. Eli responded, go in peace. So after he explains to her what's actually going on, he says, go in peace. May the God of Israel grant the request you've made of Him. May your servant find favor with you, she replied. Then Hannah went on her way. She ate and no longer looked despondent. In other words, in response to her faith and her prayer, Eli is A, reversing his original comment when he called her drunk. He's like, yeah, my bad, that wasn't true. And then B, he's also like blessing her request. He's essentially agreeing and praying her prayer, praying that her prayer will be answered, that what she wants will actually happen, that God would grant her favor, and that he also is inspired by her devotion. So again, like this guy that's supposed to be one of the most spiritual people of Israel sees this woman who's in desperate need for the Lord to move, and he's inspired by it. He's inspired by it. Verse 19, it says this, the next morning, Elkanah and Hannah got up early to worship before the Lord. Afterward, they returned home to Ramah. Then Elkanah was intimate with his wife, Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. Now, just to point this out, in the Old Testament, when God remembers, it does not mean like, oh, God forgot. It's like, oh, yeah, you're doing this thing. No, what it's talking about is God's going to move. So when God remembers in the Old Testament, it means he's going to move. Verse 20, after some time, Hannah conceived and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel because she said, I requested him from the Lord. So Samuel means something to the effect of name of God or offspring of God or God has heard, that she requested, God has heard, and so she gives him the name Samuel. That she here in this story was faithful to God, even in her disappointment, and God was gracious to her. And so what happens next is the next year, when the family travels to Shiloh, she stayed back because she was still nursing Samuel, but she promises to bring Samuel to Shiloh once he is weaned, which likely isn't just a reference to breastfeeding. It also likely has a certain level of independence to it. So basically when Samuel is either probably somewhere between the age of like 2 and 5, she's going to bring him back to Shiloh. And if you look a couple verses down, verse 24, here is how the chapter ends. It says, when she had weaned him, she took him with her to Shiloh, as well as a 3-year-old bull, a half a bushel of flour, and a clay jar of wine. Though the boy was still young, she took him to the Lord's house at Shiloh. Then they slaughtered the bull and brought the boy to Eli, who was the high priest. Verse 26, please, my lord, she said, as surely as you live, my lord, I am the woman who stood beside you, who stood here beside you, praying to the Lord. I prayed for this boy, and since the Lord gave me what I asked him for, I now give the boy to the Lord. For as long as he lives, he is given to the Lord. Then he, that is Samuel, worshiped the Lord there. And so what happens is Samuel is raised and brought up at Shiloh in service of the Lord. Hannah goes on, if you continue to read 1 Samuel, Hannah goes on to have 5 more kids. So she has 3 more sons after Samuel and 2 more daughters. Samuel eventually grows up. He becomes the last judge over Israel, leading the people both politically and spiritually as a prophet before he anoints Saul as Israel's first king in 1 Samuel chapter 10. Though even when Saul becomes king, obviously Samuel still has a very leading influence. He eventually also anoints King David as Saul's successor, though he dies before David is actually appointed as king, and he dies. And all of this, so the amazing life of Samuel and 1 and 2 Samuel, the throne of King David of which our Messiah has come from, all of this started and can be traced back to the faithfulness of Hannah, who did not abandon the Lord in the midst of her disappointment, in the midst of her resentment, in the midst of her anger, in the midst of her doubt. For some reason, she did not abandon the Lord. So the question for us this morning was this: what should we do when we are disappointed with God? Because we will be disappointed. Listen, some of you are right now. What should we do when we are disappointed with God? Man, here's my encouragement for you from this text. Don't let disappointment win. Don't let disappointment win. It's not that you can pretend like everything's fine. It's not that you pretend that you are not disappointed, but that you do not let it win. Listen, all of this, the rise of Samuel, the anointing of the kings, the shaping of Israel's future started with one woman who brought her pain to God. She refused in her pain to let pride win, and then she was willing to surrender what she wanted most, which was a son, or which was a child, back to the Lord. That's what she did. And hear me, God may not answer your prayers in your timing or in the way that you expect, but hear me, your disappointment in the meantime, it does not have to win. And the way we battle it, the way we kind of make sure that disappointment does not ultimately win is we pray. Is that we follow Jesus in community, that we worship, and we continue to show up. Romans 12 says this, again, if you read the word with me when we get to it, Romans 12:12, Paul says this, rejoice in hope, be patient in affliction, be persistent in prayer. Be persistent. This is not, again, pretend like you're not upset. This is not pretend that you don't have disappointment. This is not don't tell everybody or don't tell anybody that you're struggling. This is in the midst of what you're facing, be persistent in the Lord of armies who is gracious and kind to provide and to do for us what we actually need. So if I just want to say this as we come to a close here, man, don't let disappointment. If you're not a Christian, man, here's your next step, is to follow Jesus, to go from death to life in Jesus's name. So listen, it's not about like getting your life together or promising to be better in the future or coming to church more or praying more, which those things can certainly be helpful. Man, your next step is to confess that you're a sinner, that you have fallen short of God's perfect standard, and that Jesus came to live a life you could not live, die the death that you deserve so that you can go from death to life in Jesus' name. In Romans chapter 12, we're simply told this, if you confess with your mouth and believe in your heart that Jesus rose from the dead, you will be saved. Man, that is your next step. Christian, those of us that are followers of Jesus, listen, don't let disappointment win. And if you're in that moment right now where you're like disappointed about some things, can I just ask you, how persistent are you going to be with this? Will you let your discouragement, your anger, your resentment win? Or will you say, Lord, I don't know what you're doing and I don't know why, but I'm going to continue to seek you and to ask for you to move, not just for my good, but also for the good of others. Would we not let disappointment win? Would we go to the throne of grace? Would we seek the Lord? And would we also invite others to do so on our behalf so that we can collectively celebrate when God moves in power? Would you pray with me?